afternoon. I'm Kevin Clements, Director of the Toyota Peace Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you all to the first public conversation on the theme of cooperative security, arms control, and disarmament. I can think of no one better than Gareth Evans to be our opening speaker in this series. Gareth is probably Australia's foremost policymaker and commentator on foreign policy and international relations. He's combined careers in the law, politics, and advocacy, and has made major contributions to building regional security architecture in Asia, focusing on ways of preventing nuclear war, and establishing guidelines for enhancing multilateral capacity to protect peoples when states are failing and causing suffering. As Foreign Minister of Australia, he was crucial to the development of the Cambodian Peace Plan, the International Chemical Weapons Convention, the APEC Forum, and the ASEAN Regional Forum, and significantly for today's conversation, the Canberra Commission on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. There are many other things that I could mention, but this is enough to let you know that we're in the presence of someone who retains his youthful optimism, coupled with a realistic understanding of what is politically possible. Gareth, warm welcome. I'm also joined in this conversation by Professor Ramesh Thakkar, Prof Emeritus of ANU and a former Vice Rector of the UNU. He's widely published in the field of international relations and is Toyota's Senior Research Fellow responsible for the Cooperative Security Program. So as an opening question, Gareth, I wonder if we could sort of go back to the 1990s and talk a little bit about the work you did then on cooperative security and the importance of conflict prevention, preventive diplomacy, and all the robust regional orders that we envisaged as guiding processes for states in the UN.
Well, thanks very much for that very generous introduction, Kevin, and I'm delighted to join you and Ramesh in this conversation. It's hard now to sort of recreate the sense of confidence and optimism we really had back there in the late 80s, the early 90s. With the end of the Cold War, the breakup of the paralysis, it seemed, in the Security Council and the opportunities that gave for a quite fundamentally more constructive approach to building sustainable peace worldwide. It was in that context, as you say, that I published this little book, Cooperating for Peace, a so-called Blue Book, which I suppose did two main things. One, it built a conceptual argument around the absolute centrality of the notion of cooperative security. And cooperative security, as I articulated it in the book, had essentially three components. One, the classic Olaf Palmer common security. You build your security, you best guarantee your security with others rather than against them. It also had the element of comprehensive security, that security was about more than just the military dimension. It was multidimensional, had a human security or individual dimension, which it was important to cultivate. And also a third element was a little bit of an element of the traditional collective security notion, that when security threats did arise that seemed unable to be met by any other means, then the capacity for group response and group military response had to be part of the enterprise. What we then did in the book was really building on Boutros Ghali's Agenda for Peace, tried to develop in much more operational detail a conceptual framework for the delivery of conflict prevention and resolution. And it was essentially a continuum that we described in great detail, starting with the prevention of the outbreak of conflict through pre-conflict peace building, the institutional developments that were important in creating the environment in which peace both within countries and across borders could be sustained, but also emphasizing the concept of preventive diplomacy and preventive deployments, thin blue line military commitments designed to inhibit potential aggression. Second dimension of it was the prevention of the continuation of conflict, if you like, conflict resolution through peacemaking strategies and then peacekeeping strategies to ensure that peace agreements, once reached, could in fact be sustained. A very underdeveloped concept at that stage in the UN, in principle, yes, with going back to the early days of Doug Hammarskjöld, but not in practice part of the UN repertoire, and we thought it should be central and articulated that case, but also as part of the prevention of the continuation of war, we focused on the need for peace enforcement, as we described it, which is the military response. And I suppose the key contribution there was to begin the task of articulating a set of criteria, both legal criteria and prudential criteria, which should govern the use of force. And that was an important contribution to the debate. Then the last element, I suppose, in the continuum was the prevention of recurrence of conflict, which brought us back to the notion of peace building, but peace building in a post-conflict environment, so that you try to address the underlying causes of conflict, whether they're economic or social or whatever, and really introduce institutional measures to control them. So that was the core dimensions of this book. And of course, it was an environment in which this sort of general approach did meet with quite a lot of early and visible success. Two notable examples, the Cambodian Peace Plan, which Australia was quite central in formulating and delivering, but which did require and achieved the cooperation hitherto unprecedented of the major powers on the Security Council. And also, of course, the first Gulf War. I mean, we don't like talking about military exercises and conflict in that sense, but here was a classic confrontation, a tearing up of the post-1945 rule book about cross-border aggression. Here was a united Security Council response and a very effective, effectively delivered and constrained military response. So not only was this ferment of ideas going on, but there was also quite, in those early days, quite a lot of effective practical implementation of those ideas.
Yeah, and in terms of the concrete consequences and so forth, then why do you feel that somehow that momentum has failed to sort of move into the 2000s and beyond? I mean, what's your explanation of the marginalization of
processes? A lot of things did go wrong. What were they? First of all, missed opportunities. And I think one of the biggest, which we're now seeing some of the fruits of with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, was the failure to embrace Russia, the Russian Federation, within the larger European security system. The problem, as I've always seen it, was not so much that NATO was expanded up to Russia's borders. Now, the problem was that NATO expansion stopped there. There was a failure to conceptualize the possibility of Russia actually being part of NATO. It was talked about a little bit around the edges, but it wasn't seriously pursued. There was just this inability to think beyond the notion that Russia was them and the rest of us were us. And that was managed easily enough for a couple of decades, but we are seeing the fruits of that failure to embrace Russia within the European collective right now. A second problem, I think, was a failure to realise the full potential of the regional organisations. That had been one of the big themes of the Blue Book, Cooperating for Peace, and a lot of the discussion in the 90s and the development of regional security architecture, dialogue, forums, organizations. In the Asia Pacific area, for example, we had the ASEAN Regional Forum, established in the early 90s, with the hope that it would rapidly evolve into not just a confidence building dialogue mechanism, but a vehicle for effective conflict prevention and ultimately conflict resolution. But such did not prove to be the case. It just lost momentum, and it's still to this day fumbling around in the confidence building space without having done anything more substantial in the South China Sea or anywhere else. I think another thing that went wrong in the 1990s was a failure to respond effectively to mass atrocity crimes. We can all remember the conflict in the Balkans, the horrors of Rwanda, of course, in 1994, 800,000 people being butchered within the space of just a couple of months, and the reaction from the international community being impossibly limp. We had the Srebrenica affair, 8,000 men and boys being taken out and massacred by Serbian military forces while the UN just stood by impotently. All of this was partly redressed by the Responsibility to Protect movement, with which I was closely associated. We may have something more to say about that, I guess, later on, with the report of the Commission and then the 2005 resolution of the UN General Assembly meeting as the World Summit, in which a new normative approach to this was embraced. But nonetheless, clearly our ability to deal once and for all effectively with mass atrocity crimes has been one of the things that has continued to be a real problem in that post-90s period. There was the catastrophic bypassing of the UN Security Council and any kind of sense of coherence or decency in the Second Gulf War, the US-led assault on Iraq, unsupported by any real evidence about weapons of mass destruction, possession, or human rights violations, while of a scale that would justify this kind of invasive response. Or any evidence of Iraq as a supporter of state terrorism, which justified, it just didn't happen. And this with consequences that we've been living with ever since. What else went wrong, or what happened? There was the big tectonic plate shift, obviously, with the rise of China, accompanied by an absolute unwillingness on the part of the United States to cede anything in the nature of primacy or preeminence. I think I've often quoted it, but there was a line that I heard Bill Clinton utter when 2 years after he left the presidency, 2002, at a private gathering I attended with him in California, in which he said, in this environment of the early 2000s, America's got two choices about the way in which we use this great and still, as it then was, unrivaled economic and military power. We can use that power to try to stay top dog on the global block in perpetuity. Or, this was obviously his preference, we could use that great and unrivaled power to create a world in which we are comfortable living when we're no longer top dog on the global block. And I thought that was a pitch perfect and very prescient acknowledgement of the reality of China's rise, which had then assumed nothing like the epic proportions that it now has, but nonetheless was a visible factor on the scene. And for America not to accommodate itself emotionally, intellectually, to the reality of that rise and the co-equal status that China would eventually have, and America's failure to this day to accommodate itself is the source of endless continuing problems. I think, and the final thing I would say is that's gone wrong is, and we can explore, I suppose, multiple possible explanations for this, is the rise of nationalism and the Trump has had a hell of a lot to do with this. The assertiveness that's been associated with Xi Jinping in China has manifestly reinforced it. We're seeing almost a caricature of it with Putin's behavior in Russia. But the ability of authoritarian nationalists to take over the national leadership, the policy reins in far too many countries around the world, has fed into this lack of confidence in multilateral institutions, the United Nations. It's fed into an environment where it's been increasingly difficult to realize the ambitions that we all had back there in those golden optimistic days of the early 90s.
Oh, great, very comprehensive response. In the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the US Secretary of Defense's comment just last week that the whole point of this campaign wasn't just to preserve Ukrainian independence, but to weaken Russia, it would seem that Biden's pursuing the desire to be top dog again in a very quiet way. In that context, do you think that the cooperative security principles can be resuscitated for the world. I mean, it seems to me that they're just so obvious, but you know, it does seem that we're not only moving in the direction of more nationalism, but you know, NATO is being revived and the EU's beefing up its own security capacity. So what do you think of the prospects for these cooperative security?
Well, it's not impossible, Kevin, but it's obviously going to be very hard. And it's not helped, I have to say, by that kind of posture we're still hearing from the United States and from both sides of the US political spectrum, the unwillingness to embrace serious multilateralism, the unwillingness to vest serious confidence in multilateral institutions that the US itself does not completely control. And therein lies a fundamental problem for the whole concept of cooperative security, for common security. And we're going to continue finding it very difficult. But I think we need to recognize, and there's that old line that the Chinese characters for crisis involve both danger and opportunity. And out of crisis and out of the series of crises that we've been experiencing recently, I think we do see the potential for the opportunity for a resurrected momentum towards multilateral cooperation and a serious attention to these global and regional public goods issues. I mean, the global financial crisis back in 2008 saw the G20 emerge then. It's waned in significance since, as just a major player in developing a cooperative policy response, a sensible policy response to that. The G20 played a blinder in that respect, and there's a message there about what can be done when minds are sufficiently concentrated. I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine should be seen, should operate as a global wake-up call on the absolute need to reinforce cooperative security principles, cooperative security mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Now, the pandemic and COVID, obviously another global wake-up call, if only we heed it, on the absolute necessity for these situations, which are beyond the capacity for any one country or small group of countries to manage control. They're genuinely global problems and they demand cooperative global solutions. Climate change, quintessentially obvious, another example where the wake-up call is being heard, is being experienced, and I think we should have some confidence in the growing momentum right around the world and even the most unlikely places for serious response to that. So, you know, out of crisis does arguably come opportunity. And I just hope that the other great existential risk of our time, nuclear war, will also be seen in the context that you've just described of Russia's threats of nuclear weapons and so on as demanding a cooperative response too. But so far, that's a bit of a bust.
Okay. Ramesh, over to you.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the sort of question that I want to raise. Gareth, let's start with a very broad, open-ended comment from you on how you assess the current state of the nuclear arms control architecture. Because, of course, you've been involved in this issue from so many different angles and for such a long time, starting with your famous visit to Hiroshima that got you interested in this in the first place. So over to you.
Well, as of you, Ramesh, and it's been a pleasure to work with you over the years in the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament and multiple other enterprises to try and get some sanity into the nuclear environment. Unfortunately, there's not much sanity visible at all now. The structure that we're dealing with, the situation we're dealing with, is pretty awful, just about any way in which you look at it. For a start, every one of the nuclear armed states, all nine of them, are either modernizing or increasing their arsenals or both. We have at the moment still something like 13,000 nuclear weapons in existence around the world, with the destructive power between them of something over 100,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. We know the numbers. 90% of those nukes are held in United States and Russian hands. China, the next biggest, only 350 or so at the moment, but rapidly increasing its arsenal. France and the United Kingdom with nuclear stockpiles in the 200s. India, Pakistan getting close to 200 each. Israel getting close to 100, although, of course, not acknowledging that it has anything at all. North Korea, maybe only half that at the moment, but with its stockpile increasing. And with very little interest by any of them in downsizing, despite the big changes that were made, the big advances that were made in stockpile reductions by United States and Russia in the early, you know, post-Cold War years. But you've got this kind of Gordian knot between, you know, Pakistan fearing India, India fearing China, China fearing the United States, and none of them wanting as a result to step backwards. You've got the non-proliferation regime limping, obviously continuing to be driven emotionally by a distaste for the absolute unwillingness of any of the weapon states to take seriously their commitment to move towards disarmament under the non-proliferation treaty. You've got the Iran problem still remaining unresolved with the utter inability of Trump's assault on the JCPOA, the joint proposal, which was agreed and was a major step forward in 2015, the utter inability so far of negotiations to reverse that. You've got proliferation sentiment starting to visibly grow in countries like South Korea, which is really pretty disconcerting. We have had the big normative step forward of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which has now come into force with the significant majority of the world's states supporting it. But of course, none of the nuclear armed states and none of the umbrella states that believe, for better or worse, that they're benefiting from the nuclear umbrella will have anything to do with the Prohibition Treaty. So it remains at best an aspiration rather than anything that's remotely likely to be operationally effective. Other key arms control instruments, agreements are either dead now, like the ABM Ballistic Missiles Treaty, the Open Skies Treaty, the INF Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, or they're on life support, like New START. You've got other moves to try to get some sanity back into the system being rejected. And the latest United States Nuclear Posture Review has rejected outright the move towards no first use doctrine, which many of us were pinning our hopes and faith on. Russia has been talking up for quite some time and is doing so again, the possibility of using nuclear weapons, at least at the tactical level. There's increased interest in NATO and other US allies and nuclear sharing arrangements where nuclear weapons are actually becoming more readily operationally available with allies actually participating in their delivery. And all of that is unfortunately softening the taboo norm. So when you put all those different threads together, it's a pretty unhappy picture at the moment, and pretty hard to sustain the optimism that you and I have traditionally had about moving forward on that front.
It is. I think if you can link this to an earlier comment you made in the part with Kevin, it would be an ironic, in fact, outright perverse consequence if Russia in part reacted in the Ukraine invasion to the eastward expansion of NATO, that the invasion in turn might trigger emplacement of nuclear weapons even closer to Russia's borders with some of the other allies. Which then takes me to the next question. I mean, you had a very powerful report from your ICNIT, the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, entitled Eliminating Nuclear Threats. So where does that agenda stand today?
Well, despite the coming into force of the treaty, the Nuclear Ban Treaty, I think we have to acknowledge that there's a diminished and perhaps diminishing worldwide constituency for actual elimination. The love affair with nuclear deterrence, the utility of deterrence, has been clearly reinforced by Russia's actions. It's also been reinforced by the China build-up of its arsenal and the manifest move away from a minimal deterrence posture that China has traditionally adopted. Developments in North Korea, as we've already said. We are also seeing a renewed articulation of that old line that Libya would never have been invaded or suffered regime change if it had kept its nukes, that Ukraine would be safer if it had nuclear weapons. But I think those are terribly misconceived positions, in the sense that weapons that are essentially unusable, and they're certainly unusable by smaller states because of the consequences of doing so, the suicidal consequences of doing so. Weapons which are unusable are not really, when you think about it, very effective deterrence. They might be deterrence, they might be psychologically or politically comforting, but militarily, their utility is of extremely questionable status. There has also been, I think, a general failure to appreciate the force of that mantra that was first articulated in the Canberra Commission that Australia initiated back in 96, and also very much in the Japan-Australia Commission that you mentioned, ICNND, the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation Disarmament, that I co-chaired with the former Japanese Foreign Minister Yuriko Kawaguchi, and in which you, Ramesh, played a very important role in our report. And that mantra, of course, was one that's really worth recalling and continuing to emphasize. It goes like this: so long as any state has nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as any state retains nuclear weapons, they're bound one day to be used, if not deliberately, aggressively, then by accident, miscalculation, human error, system error, human idiocy. And thirdly, any such use is bound to be catastrophic for life on this planet as we know it. It's very, very important that that message continues to be reiterated, because it seems to have lost its traction in recent times. It's critically important to bring not just non-proliferation, with which so many countries are comfortable, back onto the serious agenda. Elimination has to be brought back onto the agenda. But it has to be brought back realistically. Just parroting the desirability of instant coffee elimination, or, no global zero by 2025, global zero by 2030, and hammering that, by itself, that's not likely to be very productive. And the best can indeed, in this context, as in so many others, can be the enemy of the good. I think what you have to do is recognize the reality that elimination in the present environment is a long, long way away, and that the best we can hope for is a progressive move toward that, with a minimization agenda in the first instance rather than an elimination agenda. And that was the core theme, you'll recall, of the Australia-Japan ICNND, the need to focus very hard on a roadmap which would get us there step by step, and build a constituency, hopefully a self-reinforcing constituency over time, for what ultimately we must continue to embrace. And that's the goal of ridding the world of these most indiscriminately inhumane weapons ever invented.
Thanks, Gareth. I think we've covered most of what I wanted to raise next, but I want to nonetheless raise it in a more direct fashion. And I'm going to convert it into a two-part question. You mentioned that it's not the right environment. It's more than 50 years since the NPT came into force. Article 6, of course, famously commits the five nuclear weapon states to pursue nuclear disarmament in good faith. And then we had the World Court's advisory opinion in 96 or 97, whatever it was, that strengthen that obligation that they need to pursue and bring to a conclusion. They've always argued, yes, we are committed to it eventually, but now is not the right time. And many of us on the other side, including yourself, have argued, well, no time is going to be ideal time, but we do need to begin taking concrete steps. Otherwise, there's a finite but real risk of these weapons being used, if not by design, then inadvertently along the lines of the Canberra Commission three-part conclusion that you read out. And what we see in Ukraine today is exactly that. The fact that we didn't address this seriously enough and aggressively enough means that when a serious geopolitical crisis arises, it becomes part of the normalized new discourse, the reality of nuclear weapons. And that raises two questions. One, most of which have been addressed, but you'll have got the column from our mutual friend Chung In-moon overnight, where he's pointing out that this has raised the debate in South Korea again, and we know it's raised it other places. And we need to answer that very forcefully, that in fact it doesn't prove the utility. And in relation to that, the second part, which is what we have seen, I think, is on the one hand, yes, the Russian regime has warned off further NATO involvement by reminding everyone of the nuclear weapons. Yet, in fact, NATO and particularly the United States have gone quite far in the material assistance to Ukraine, including the report in the New York Times yesterday, which I expect you've seen, that US intelligence was useful in identifying commanding generals from the Russian army who've been, I think they said, about a dozen have been assassinated. So the lesson for North Korea may not necessarily be all that good, that it is possible to go in for a serious conventional response, reversing the reason during the Cold War between Russia and NATO as to which side had weapons and which side has superior conventional military might. So where does that leave us in terms of the utility and how we argue for the utility or lack thereof in persuading states not to go down that path?
Well, you've bundled up an awful lot of issues there, and let's just untangle a couple of them. I think the issue of the utility of weapons is one that's vastly overstated. In the context of North Korea, for example, the notion that that North Korea is seriously buying itself some protection through having this nuclear arsenal is one I think that is fundamentally misconceived, because the only protection you buy is from weapons that are actually usable and are likely to be used. And of course, North Korea knows that any aggressive use of its nuclear arsenal will attract an overwhelming response, which it would be utterly incapable of effectively resisting. Through conventional capability alone, the United States, with South Korean support, could reduce North Korea essentially to a car park. And that is an inhibiting thing for North Korea to be contemplating. So any first use by it of nuclear weapons would generate that response. It would be suicidal for the regime. And that similarly would have been the case for Ukraine, even if it had retained not only the physical weapons, but the operational capacity to use them, which in fact it didn't. That was very much in Moscow's hands at the time of the breakup of the Federation. So, I mean, although obviously the existence of nuclear weapons on the other side does concentrate people's minds and does obviously generate a degree of additional caution about engaging in military adventurism of any kind, it's very hard to argue that it's that the possession of nuclear weapons is actually decisive as a deterrent. It didn't stop all sorts of military exchanges occurring, as you well know, between India and Pakistan, the presence of nuclear weapons on both sides. It didn't stop Kargil and various other things of that kind. Weapons that are basically not usable, that everybody knows are not usable because of the retaliatory consequences that you will generate, because of the blowback of the radioactivity and so on that you can generate in closely proximate countries that might be minded to use nuclear weapons against each other. All of these things, you know, militate against the utility of nuclear weapons. And I think, you know, the best articulation of that argument was by those very fierce collection of Cold War realists, Kissinger, Shultz, Perry, and Nunn, in their famous series of Wall Street Journal articles, when they said that whatever might have been the utility, which they obviously believed in, of nuclear weapons in staving off catastrophe during the Cold War years, the risks associated with the possession by nuclear weapons of anyone in the current environment far outweigh any conceivable security benefits that flow from their possession. And we just know from the opening up of Cold War archives how close we came to catastrophe on multiple occasions through the inadvertency issues that we've talked about, the mistake issues, the human idiocy issues. So there it is. So in this environment, obviously, if we had been more effective in getting towards an elimination path, there would be less incentive for Russia to be brandishing its nuclear weapons as a threat. There would be less credibility about that than there perhaps still is at the moment. But I don't think there's very much credibility about the potential Russian use of nuclear weapons at the moment. I think it is braggadocio of the first order. But one has to be careful about this. I was one of the many who didn't think Russia would actually invade Ukraine on a full-scale basis. I thought we're up for a bit of salami slicing, but not the kind of full-scale invasion that occurred. So maybe my judgment will be utterly unreliable when it comes to Putin using nuclear weapons. But I think in this present environment, I don't know whether you want to come onto this. I mean, what should our strategy be? I mean, I think it is quixotic to hope that we're going to move quickly anytime soon towards nuclear elimination. What we can hope for, all we can really hope for, is agreement on a serious nuclear risk reduction approach.
Well, I do want you to talk about that, particularly in the context of the nuclear calendar for the rest of the year. Next month, we have the first meeting of the states parties of the nuclear ban treaty. Later on in the year, we have the convening, hopefully this time, of the oft-postponed 50th anniversary NPT review conference. Given that, you'd think that the two groups would actually pursue the vast majority of common elements they share instead of opposing each other and in many cases vilifying one another. So given that, is nuclear risk reduction one way forward for bringing the two parts together in the shared agenda of reducing nuclear risks on the way to elimination of the weapons?
Yeah, I think there is obviously a lot of potential common ground there, and it's that we must focus on. Again, not making the best of the enemy the good, not being too absolutist in our insistence move toward nirvana, but just focusing on the step-by-step process. And I think there are four elements in risk reduction that are all crucially important. One of them is doctrine, getting people actually signed up to no first use or a declaration of the sole purpose of nuclear weapons is to retaliate against their threatened use or their actual use by others. Unfortunately, the hopes that so many of us had that the United States would move in that direction, as foreshadowed both by President Obama and of course by President Biden and in past incarnations, unfortunately that hasn't borne fruit, and the nuclear umbrella states, Australia among them, have continued to sort of say to the United States, we're desperately anxious that you not give up any notion of using nuclear weapons other than in a retaliatory nuclear context. That's very disappointing, but I think the doctrine thing remains center front in its importance. And unless we can get some degree of consensus among the existing nuclear armed states and those who sail with them on this, we're not going to make very much progress at all. But doctrine's not the only game in town. And of course, doctrine doctrinal statements by themselves, unaccompanied by other operational developments, may not have all that much credibility. The three other risk reduction measures that are very important in my mind are the other three Ds, apart from doctrine. There's deployment. At the moment, we have something like 4,000 of that stockpile of 13,000 nuclear weapons actively deployed. And so long as they are deployed, and not needing to go through any elaborate process before they're actually usable, the risk of their inadvertent use is obviously very much higher. And just generally, it would be a huge confidence building measure if we could dramatically reduce the scale of those deployments, particularly by the United States and Russia. The third risk reduction measure that's crucial is de-alerting, taking the 2,000 or so weapons that are at the moment on extremely dangerous high alert, high launch alert status. In that status, because of the principle, if you've got an incoming wave of nuclear weapons coming at you, you've got to have the capacity to immediately retaliate before they land and knock out a lot of your own capability, use them or lose them. But therein lies the capacity for terrible mistakes to be made. And just about every sane analyst's agenda is doing something very, very serious about de-alerting. And the final D in risk reduction that would be important is simply decreased numbers. That's not happening at the moment. And it won't happen so far as the other nuclear armed states are concerned, unless there's further dramatic deterioration in numbers by the United States and Russia. But the reality is that effective nuclear deterrence, if you accept the theory of nuclear deterrence, does not demand nuclear weapons on the scale they presently exist and the numbers they presently exist. Minimal deterrence can be very effective with dramatically lower numbers. We estimated in the Australia-Japan Commission that with supreme confidence in their utility, if you still believe in nuclear weapons, both the United States and Russia could go down to 500 weapons each, as compared with the 6,000 or 7,000 that each of them have at the moment. And of course, if the United States were to do that, there would be much greater probability of curbing the expansionist inclinations of China and the other nuclear armed states. So I think it's very, very important that we articulate those risk reduction measures and seriously campaign and advocate for them. The umbrella states in the Asia Pacific, in Europe, believing they're sheltering under the US nuclear umbrella, are especially important if we are to take forward any serious nuclear risk reduction agenda. Voices of our countries simply must be heard, and they haven't been for a long time. One other thing is important, I think, to focus on in this context, and that's the importance of the nuclear weapons-free zones around the world. Some of them still not fully operational because they haven't had complete buy-in from the nuclear-armed states. But also in the context, for example, of getting some sanity into the Korean Peninsula situation, the concept of a Northeast Asian nuclear weapon-free zone, in which the nuclear-free status of South Korea, Japan, and a cooperating North Korea would be guaranteed by the other region's nuclear powers. These are all strategies that have been very carefully thought through and articulated by many analysts. And they need to get back onto the agenda, because just limping forward as we are in the present environment, going backwards on the aspirations for nuclear elimination is not a happy place to be.
This conversation has been a good publicity event for several of your books and reports, Gareth. Let me bring in yet another one, a more recent one, but also again, a very good one, Incorrigible Optimist. Oh, yes. To round off this topic, take us through why you remain committed to the cause and optimistic of success, assuming, of course, that you do.
Well, I'm not as incorrigibly optimistic as I used to be, and when I rather bravely used that title for my memoir. And I'm certainly not as youthful as I used to be, having regard to Kevin's introduction in that respect. But I still believe that you have to be optimistic if you are to get any kind of sensible change on any of the sorts of topics that we're going to be talking about. Both optimism and pessimism are very self-reinforcing. Pessimism is self-defeating. If you're constantly looking on the dark side, what can go wrong? You're never likely to be very adventurous in policy terms. You're never likely to do anything that will make any difference at all. Whereas if you are an optimist by nature, you're constantly looking for the openings. You're constantly looking for what you can build on and reinforce. And basically, you know, you just don't get out of bed in the mornings to do any of this stuff unless you believe that the change is possible. So I think it's very important to retain that spirit, as difficult as it sometimes is to harness and energize. And it's absolutely critical that we continue to campaign on these fronts. We're not going to get much joy top down from the leaderships as currently constituted of any of the nuclear states. But the peer group pressure that can be mounted internationally, nuclear umbrella states, as I've already identified, but many others as well, those countries that have been leading players in the development of the nuclear ban treaty and so on. It's very important that that momentum be sustained. And of course, it's equally important that the bottom-up pressure be sustained from civil society. By itself, it's unlikely to be able to make a fundamental difference despite all the efforts of nuclear anti-nuclear campaigners over so many decades. But without that bottom-up pressure, governments, and I know from having been in politics as long as I was, governments simply don't feel the same pressure on them to take positions, to actually act. So if nothing else, that that visible community sentiment is tremendously important to sustain. So, the basic message is, as frustrating as it is, as difficult it is, it just really is important to maintain that spirit of optimism, because it's only in that context that anything is likely to happen.
Well, I think Kevin's another fellow optimist. So, Kevin, back to you.
Yes. So I've got one question which flows out of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, you know, as you and others felt, was, you know, was intensely unlikely in the 21st century to have a sort of a war of aggression to kind of change boundaries and change regimes and so forth. I mean, in the light of that, what do you consider the future of war fighting to be? I mean, is this now giving an example to China in relation to Taiwan and other countries to start revisiting the old agreements about world order and national boundaries and borders? And what global institutions are capable of controlling and managing this, really unwarranted example?
Well, you're right, Kevin, that the Russian invasion, I think, came as a huge shock to us all, tearing up, as it really did, the 1945 rule book, the assumption that cost-benefit would always come out against major territorial aggression. With the experience of Iraq in 1991 and the reaction of the world to that behind us, we thought that should be a lesson to anyone minded to go down that particular path. Maybe there'd be some salami slicing of the kind that we saw with Georgia and Crimea in the last decade. But I think the assumption that we'd be back confronting the kind of naked cross-border aggression that we've seen now from Russia was pretty startling. But I think, again, maybe this is just the incorrigible optimist in me coming out, I still think, looking to the future and the prospect of further such war fighting, I think the prospect of cross-border aggression is much less likely for the future than it was in the all the years up to World War II. I mean, technological developments, and I'm not talking about the weapons of mass destruction, but, you know, precision-guided munitions and now cyber artificial intelligence and all the implications of that. These technological developments mean that in the contemporary age, the scale of the horror, the scale of the misery that's associated with any fighting war is really exponentially greater than it was in the past. I mean, the World War I was exponentially greater than anything that had been seen in the 19th century. World War II was exponentially greater than World War I. But now, I mean, the scale of the destruction that's associated with almost any warfare is just is almost beyond contemplation. And I think, you know, what's been happening in Russia will in Ukraine will reinforce the perception that even if the war had been you know, pursued rather more efficiently than it has been by the Russian military so far, the scale of the destruction has still been so ugly, and the nature of the misery that's involved and the absence of any quick and clean solutions will be a wake-up call, or concentrate the minds of those in China that might have been, for example, minded to pursue a military case against, to be emboldened to take a military action against Taiwan. If I'm wrong about all of that, and any conflict, further conflict of a serious kind does break out, unfortunately, we can't hope for much by way of effective response from the existing global institutions. The United Nations Security Council paralysis through the use of the veto will be with us for the indefinite future. Secretary General's good offices function as only as effective as the personality of the incumbent, as we've seen with the rather limp response of the present incumbent to the current situation. The General Assembly of the United Nations may be an effective normative force when it comes close to unanimity in its responses to these cases, but it's clearly not operationally capable of delivering anything. The more important institutional responses in future, as now, will be coming from regional organizations, from NATO, obviously, from the European Union, which is getting its act together in collective military defense terms. We've seen some of this in with the ECOWAS in West Africa, for example, regional organizations being very often quite effective responders to the disposition to engage in unconscionable military aggression. And other mechanisms, of course, like highly targeted and effective economic or financial sanctions are also going to be part of the response. I think also minilateral or plurilateral security cooperation is going to continue to be an important element in dealing with and preventing war fighting occurring in future. I know there's quite a lot of skepticism or outright hostility towards the Quad, for example, the cooperative security, short of an alliance, but nonetheless a cooperative security gathering up of the combined resources of the United States, Japan, India, and Australia, maybe to become the quint with Korean participation in at some reasonably early stage. I think that might have more preventive utility than the critics sometimes acknowledge, and we might see more of this in the future. But the bottom line is that I think most political leaders have just internalized at last, and maybe the Russian experience will reinforce this, you know, that war is just not the answer to nationalist aspirations and any dimension of national interest, whether it's in security terms or whether it's in economic terms. It's just not an answer, because the costs are invariably going to outweigh the benefits in the current environment. That's perhaps too positive, too optimistic a take on all of this, but it's all I can offer to keep myself.
You've answered a few more of my current questions. This is a sort of a slight provocative, but goes back to Australia. I mean, do you think that AUKUS and the agreement to develop nuclear submarines is stabilizing or destabilizing in the context of big power transitions in Asia?
Well, in an Australian context, I think you have to acknowledge that we've got a gigantic coastline to defend, that we were put at risk even in World War II technology times by Japanese submarines shelling Sydney and Newcastle, as well as bombing Darwin, and any country has to develop serious capability. Now, surface ships seem to have had their days as effective military units, almost as much as the tanks have, in this context. The future in defensive capability terms does lie, I think, very much not only with effective air capability, but submarines for the indefinitely foreseeable future. So countries like Australia simply have to develop these capabilities, and nuclear propelled submarines, just by their very nature, have far more endurance, far more longevity, far more speed in getting to station, and far more effective deterrent and response capability than their conventional counterparts. I think that's the reality that we have to live with. The worry, of course, about AUKUS is that Australia will become so enmeshed in United States military decision-making as a result of possessing these machines that we will lose all our remaining independence. And that's deeply, deeply troubling, deeply disconcerting. But it's a more complex and delicate equation than people sometimes give credit for. And I mean, I'm a bit torn in my response to it. I don't like the notion of recreating our dependence on the Anglosphere. I think our future continues to be in with our geography rather than our history, and in Asia, and it's far more important really in the longer run for us to develop highly credible and effective relationships with the Japans and South Koreas and the Indias and the Indonesias and the Vietnams and so on of our region than it is relying on the heroes of yesteryear to preserve us from all contingencies. But AUKUS is a tricky one. But to the extent that it has given a little bit of a cautionary signal to China, and to the extent that China has been, whatever else one can say, just a little bit on the over-assertive kind in the way in which it's been behaving in the South China Sea and various other places recently, I think just giving it that little message about the intention to push back against any overreach is an important one. And it's part of what I said before about the plurilateral and minilateral arrangements being pretty important in preserving peace in the future, as much as some of them might make us uncomfortable.
Can I just add a footnote to that, Kevin? I think given the very long timeline for the acquisition of these nuclear propelled submarines, that's actually an incredibly optimistic take on how long crises and conflicts will take to develop in this region.
Well, fair comment. And what we do in the meantime is, it's a very complex issue, and it's not been an impressive story in terms. I mean, every country has to develop military capability in the light of others' capability, not their current or presumed intent. And every one of these defense decisions involves incredibly long lead times and taking positions that might not seem to be warranted by the current environment. But you just got to keep our fingers crossed that things will hold together until we do have some capacity to defend ourselves, which we manifestly don't at the moment.
Gareth and Chair, we're at the end of our hour here, and I'd just like to thank you very much for once again demonstrating your formidable intellect, your grasp of a whole set of kind of interlinked and kind of challenging problems, for putting all of your answers into the context of the, the big sort of tectonic plates that are moving right now in terms of climate change and the pandemic and everything else that's happening. And once again, you've demonstrated, why you were such a successful foreign minister, and why in your post-foreign minister role, you continued to kind of create a sort of a sane voice in the context of a lot of kind of craziness. So thank you for that, and thank you for your optimism, and thank you for your youthful enthusiasm, which still continues to bubble away, and all power to you for the future.